The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we continue our conversation with Ian McCavity. And, you know, one of the things that amazes me is when you see the world get into crisis, you still have people trusting paper. They still seem to find whatever the most trustworthy form of safety is in their mind. It could be treasury bills. It could be dollars. At one point, it was euros. We've seen that back when the euro was trusted more. So, you know, when is it that we actually see the paper no longer look like a safe haven?
This really speaks to old habits being very difficult to break. And the fact that the investment community globally looks at the dollar as a great place to go during times of crisis, we'd agree with Mr. McCavity that it really is an indication of a need for liquidity more than even a judgment of what is safe. And they need the liquidity, therefore they go there. What they may not know, what they may not recognize is that what some consider to be safety is, has actually been degraded through time. And it still is a liquid vehicle. You want to move to the dollar, you want to move to treasuries. Clearly, that is a good choice for liquidity purposes. But what that does neglect is that there is a safety issue in play, which they may not fully appreciate.
Well, and David, you know, it reminds me of a video game that came out 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that we would play called Frogger. And it had little items going across the stream, and you had to jump across the stream to get to the other side. Now, there was no one item that you could jump on that you could stay on long, because otherwise you'd fall in the water or it'd go off the screen. So there was continual movement. Our paper currency is a little bit like Frogger, where you jump on one for a little while, you jump on another for a little while. When, however, do you get to the other side of the shore, and would that be gold?
Yeah, and this is, I think, where when we look at the international banking community in particular, what you see is that the success of developing foreign currency reserves and this massive stock of foreign currency reserves that has been built in the context of this most recent modern era version of globalization, success was forged together. But as they look down the pike, they see, yes, our survival is not managed together, it's managed apart. Hmm. And where we're beginning to see the difference between emerging markets and the developed world is the developed world owns the gold that they want and is happy to do something more quote-unquote creative with it. But the developing world, as Mr. McCavity said, $7 trillion in liquidity, yeah, is trying to figure out how exactly they manage this liquidity pool in an environment where safety is more and more an issue.
So, David, what you're saying is some of these developing countries with all these reserves are starting to realize that they need gold. I'm wondering at what point does it happen where the general populace understands the same thing?
We are in an interesting phase. Gold and silver are moving back into the limelight. This is certainly where an investor today, looking at what the Fed is doing, has to make a decision. Who do you want to manage your cash balances? The Fed is fixing prices in the bond market, reflecting on sort of the artificial nature of bond yields today. There's a real cost to maintaining these policies socially, collectively. But for the individual investor, is it clear enough yet that a gold and silver exposure is necessary? Or do you think that many investors are still going to say, yeah, but I prefer the euro, I prefer the yen, I prefer the British pound, I prefer the Swiss franc, even a U.S. Treasury holding? At what point does it become clear that central bankers have it out for the saver?
I keep wondering about the intelligence level of the world in recent years, because to me it's blatantly obvious that gold and silver have always had sort of a role in portfolio structure. That people have fallen for every hoop that Wall Street and the government have thrown at them in recent years, to the extent that people now think that somehow or other a government guarantee means something. You know, anyone that went through the MF Global experience suddenly discovers that a government guarantee is there, except if it's going to penalize a major bank, then we will look after the major bank, not the failing firm's clients. In my view, the long-term attraction of gold still is it's the only monetary asset that is universally recognized that has no counterparty risk. If you got a handful of gold coins in your hand, nobody owes it to you, and it's negotiable and fungible anywhere on the planet. When I watch the games that are going on now between the major central banks trying to prop up the credit bubble system or trying to reinflate another credit bubble, I've used the comment a couple of times in my newsletters that when I see this kind of stuff going on, the way I describe it is when the elephants are on the dance floor having a rumble, the intelligent mouse takes his gold coins and hides in the corner to avoid getting trampled on. And on the other side of the valley, let's see what paper they're offering to try and entice you to separate yourself from your gold. Because it may conceivably even be a new currency at some point. I'm just very troubled with the direction that they're heading in, because layering debt on top of debt is essentially shortening the fuse on a stick of dynamite. They're trying to buy time. They're trying to kick can down the road. And they're kicking it down the road, but at the same time, one of these times, the field goal kicker is going to suddenly realize he's trying to kick a cast iron block and breaks his foot. And you don't know when that foot-breaking incident is going to happen, but I think it's getting a lot closer.
One of the interesting things, just comparing our last conversation to this one, the bond market was, at that point, yielding 4.6%. It had moved from 3.5 to 4.6. Now we're back below 3% on the 30-year. And, you know, this question of what direction will yields go? You know, you mentioned a Barron's article talking about the uselessness of gold at about $1,000 an ounce and how lackluster it was as a performer. Well, I was reminded of that kind of thing. I don't remember if it was a Barron's or a Bloomberg article just in the last few weeks, basically arguing, look, the bond bears are all wet. Rates are down. There is no risk in the bond market, and we see that very clearly. What used to be 4.6%, implying more credit risk, is now less than 3%, and aren't we all happy? You know, clearly there's a bull market in bonds, and it's here to stay. Again, from a historical perspective, maybe we could talk just a little bit about bonds because, you know, looking back at past centuries and various bond crises, rates were not typically indicative of imminent crisis. Quite the contrary, they reached exceptionally low periods just prior to spiking higher. That was, again, via a combination of PR chicanery, manipulation of the investing public, treasury intervention, or other forms of manipulation. Now we've got the global bond market putting in new lows. Is it any different this time, or could we begin to say we're marching towards the Rubicon if we're not past the Rubicon? What does the bond market tell us of any value today?
The one thing it does tell you, if you look at the chart, I tend to track the 10-year rather than the 30-year yield, but they're about the same. But in essence, when you see the spike down in rates, that's typically the flight to liquidity. You know, they always call it flight to safety. It's really a flight to liquidity. In essence, there's still a risk of a deflationary asset value collapse as part of a stock market decline. And in a sense, the deflationist camp would be more focused on that collapse rather than looking at all of the subsequent inflationary measures that they're going to resort to try and print their way out of it. In a sense, we're doing that right now, where we've got the deflationary and the deleveraging process underway on the one hand, and they're trying to flood the system with liquidity on the other. But as an example, just the QE3, you know, allegedly putting $40 billion a month of fresh liquidity into the system, and they're going to commit it all to mortgage-backed securities as if that's somehow going to do something for housing. It's not going to do anything for housing. All they're doing is arranging a subtle transfer of bad mortgage paper from the existing banks to the Fed's balance sheet where they don't have to mark it to market. Virtually none of that money is actually going to get out into the real world, and that's what we've done with QE1 and QE2 as well. But in essence, the Fed is re-liquefying the banking system by racking up national debt, and none of that money is flowing down to the street. I think that there is a very real risk that you haven't necessarily seen the lowest low yield on the long U.S. government paper, because in the event of a very sharp stock market sell-off, people will still revert to buying Treasury paper, in part for people that are exposed on margin. When they get a margin call, the first thing you do is go to Treasury paper because it has a very positive impact on your margin requirements. So it's not just a flight to liquidity at that point. It also enhances your margin borrowing power to cover a margin shortfall. You know, the low interest rate today just reflects a moment of fear in the other financial markets in my book.
And so 1.25 is not off the table, breaking through that 10-year of 1.4, you know, again, on a flight to liquidity.
Yeah, exactly. But it would be a spiky kind of move. It's got nothing to do with markets trying to appraise future inflation prospects. Traditionally, we always thought that the bond market was making sort of a long-term forecast of growth and inflation. At this point, it's not a real market. Yeah, when you get the imbalances, it's basically the Geithner offers bonds. The Chinese don't buy them, so the Fed buys them from J.P. Morgan the following week, so the J.P. Morgan gets paid twice.
Very convenient.
Oh, it's a wonderful deal to be the funnel between the U.S. Treasury and the Fed. They get a break by placing Treasury bonds, and what they can't sell to the rest of the world, they sell to the Fed the next week.
Does QE3 and the focus on mortgage-backed securities sort of tip the hand as to where deflationary pockets still exist, commercial, residential, real estate? I mean, maybe it's junk bonds and structured financial products, but aren't they really hitting it where they're most fearful?
I think it's mostly the mortgage paper. The National Home Price Index has been sort of bouncing along the bottom for about a year at this point, but it's still back at levels that were reached at the end of 2002. And when you look at the total mortgage debt outstanding today versus 2002, when home prices were at the same level, there's $3.8 trillion of mortgage debt outstanding. There's $3.8 trillion more mortgage debt today than there was in 2002. Now, if that official mortgage debt is still outstanding, it's on somebody's books, and there is no way that that stuff is worth $3.8 trillion. Now, how it is being marked to market, we don't know. But if that's the aggregate number that's being reported, that's what they're saying it is worth. And there's $3.8 trillion more mortgage debt outstanding on today's home price level than there was when we first got to it. And to me, it's still that mortgage-backed paper is the devil that's buried in the back of the balance sheets. And I think it's coming to the fore, because that's one of the biggest problems that they have in the European banks, is they ate an awful lot of that U.S.-issued mortgage-backed paper. I think the Chinese probably did own a fair bit of it. I think they've switched a great deal of their holdings over from agency paper to direct treasury paper.
And shorter maturities.
Yeah, we're still dealing with the same mess that we had in 2007. They haven't really fixed much other than the fact that they've artificially pumped up the bank balance sheets, but I wouldn't trust those balance sheets too much.
Well, you're looking at an additional $9 trillion or thereabouts in mortgage debt that exists, so the 3.8 plus about $9 trillion extra. If there were deleveraging to occur in that sort of contemporary 2002 and forward vintage paper, you're really talking about something that can impact a far greater stock of paper. As you mark to market 3.8, there's a knock-on effect on the additional 9.
It would be an additional 6. I think the level was around 6 back in 2002. It's now about 9.8, down from, I think, about 10.8. There's a huge amount of paper that, quite clearly, when you hear reports of what 25 or 30% of mortgages are underwater, or even higher, how do you value a mortgage that's underwater and in the foreclosure process?
Well, and speaking of foreclosures, short sales, loan modifications, one of the things that goes away at the end of the year, 2013, again, there's many challenges coming, but the tax cuts go away. We've got the fiscal cliff just prior to that. And we also have the short sale and loan modification issues, where there's been an exemption made on the debt which is forgiven. It's not been counted as income, but that too goes away at year end and is, just a little bit more sand in the gears. Now, if you're going to short sale your home, you're underwater and you just have to walk away, then all of a sudden you're going to get a tax bill come April 15th. I wouldn't say adding insult to injury, but it's certainly more pressure to the system, and perhaps more pressure than the system can bear.
Oh, absolutely. They have no idea what they've swept under the rug that's going to come back and bite them. There's all kinds of stuff. And then just watching the Republican side of the arguments right now, on the one hand, you get Romney saying stuff, and then the next day Ryan's denying it by getting even less specific. So you don't know what to expect. They talk about they're going to eliminate all the loopholes, except they're not going to take away this one, that one, or the other one. I'm a Canadian watching this absolutely aghast that an economy of the size of the U.S. can be cast into a window of such total uncertainty as to what lies ahead. And then I listen to U.S. market commentators talk about what a wonderful bull market that is because Apple's up or something. I just shake my head. I've been in the business for, going back to 1961 originally. And I just shake my head and I said, I don't know what these people are smoking. It can't possibly be legal. It's just mind-boggling.
When we come back to your comments earlier about this being reminiscent of the 68 to 71 period, we had through the early 70s Jacques Roof advising the French that we were playing games and that they would be wise to pay attention to the games that we were playing. They ultimately started taking massive amounts of gold out of our official gold hoard, and then you mentioned the closing of the gold window in 71. What was it? French and Swiss both figured it out ahead of time. It appears that central bankers around the world, to some degree, are figuring it out. But 68 to 71 was actually very early on in terms of a sentiment change in terms of the gold and silver markets. So I'm just trying to figure out, if we can, where are we at in the context of this bull market? We tend to think that first stage is long behind us, where the contrarian investor took a position perhaps under $700 an ounce. Wall Street has certainly been interested and created a number of products to meet retail demand from $700 to $1,500, let's say. Are we moving into sort of a final stage, or are we more in that mid-stage still? Where are we at in terms of the historical overlay?
You're still in the mid-stage. I've been involved with gold since $35 an ounce. I still, to this day, say the single most important bull market that I ever saw in gold was in 1968, when the gold pool finally was dissembled and the free trading in gold resumed outside the United States. And we had a bull market that ran from $35 to $45. And then it came back to $35 a year and a half later. But that $10 move was the one that broke the mantle that was put on it by the banking community at that time. And in my view, one way of looking at it would be just to go to the Dow gold ratio. You know, in 1999, you could exchange one unit of the Dow to get 42 ounces of gold for it. But when you look back historically, there have been three periods since the 1890s where at the extreme in a crisis, the Dow gold ratio traded at 1-to-1 or 1.9 to 1. And we're currently at around 8-to-1, which essentially says that the trend that started back in 2000 is heading towards a 1-to-1 ratio on the Dow gold ratio. What that says is that sometime in the next, who knows whether it's 2 years or 6 years, but sometime in this decade, gold is probably going to outperform the Dow by a factor of 8. I don't know whether that occurs at a 5-digit gold price or if the Dow comes down to meet the gold price somewhere in the 3s or the 4s. I don't know. But I'm just looking at the historical relationship that when the Dow gold ratio has spiked, it's been sort of the culmination of the crisis period. And from my studies of history, I'm not sure that I've ever seen any crisis that reaches quite the magnitude of the one that we're trying to get out of now. And I don't think that this thing has blown its top yet by any means. Again, I come back to, you know, what percentage of portfolios is allocated to gold? And for a great many people, it's still minuscule. Think back to 1999 and what percentage of mutual fund portfolios were invested in high-tech internet stocks because everybody in China was going to have an email account. Intel and Cisco were the darlings at the top of that bubble. And I think before this gold cycle is done, we're going to see the same kind of lunacy for gold on this go around. We haven't even started to see that kind of thing yet.
So 8-to-1, you wouldn't be discouraged if you'd never owned an ounce of gold before, looking at not the price at 1700 and change, but looking at the relationship to paper stocks. 8-to-1 ratio, you still think is a reasonable purchase?
Oh, absolutely. Again, you've got to think it's a ratio. So think in terms of a semi-log scale. You're basically about halfway there. So you've gone from 40-odd-to-1 down to 8-to-1. So that's a multiple of 5. To go from 8-to-1 to 1-to-1, you're talking about a multiple of 8. You know, you're not even quite halfway there. You know, relative to the extremes that we saw in 1896, 1932, and 1980.
That's a challenge to wrap the mind around in terms of the math, but greater performance ahead as opposed to what we've seen in the 2001, 2002 to present period. The ratio tells you everything, doesn't it?
Basically, I've always referred to it as the ratio between old-fashioned hard money as opposed to financial assets. And what we're dealing with right now is that the financial asset bubble of the last couple of decades is coming unraveled. We don't quite know how it's going to act in its final unraveling. But what history says is the history of gold as money is at the end of the day, it will return purchasing power to people. It will protect purchasing power better than anything else. And, you know, the idea that somehow we're going to have a 1-to-1 ratio on the Dow, it could imply Zimbabwe-type hyperinflation on the one hand, although I doubt that we'll get to that anytime soon, but the potential for that exists, or it could be just some sort of a wholesale collapse of the stock market. I wouldn't bet on either of those extremes. I'm just looking at a trend and saying, okay, I will stick with the trend that's in motion. I'm not going to hold out waiting for 1.0 to 1, I can assure you of that. But it's a question of just watching it. I would say with some long-term moving averages is a discipline coming in behind it.
This is a compelling story, and I think it's one that should be followed up on. I look forward to seeing you down in New Orleans here in the next couple of weeks. And as always, look forward to your newsletter, Deliberations on World Markets. And thanks for joining us again today, sharing your insights and historical perspective. Your activity in the market has taught you many, many things and informed your instincts in ways that certainly a young buck would do well to learn from. So I appreciate you sharing with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, David, as always, Ian is a very interesting guest. Now, something that I think is interesting, in the last 2 weeks, as we've listened to Ian, he's covered a lot of different subjects. And, you know, the Dow Gold Ratio is one, and I'd like to talk about that here in a few minutes. But something that was fascinating to me, because you've had me study this, and you've had the office study this, was that period of time while we were on a gold standard from 1968 to 1971, when certain countries around the world started to see it breaking down. And, you know, Jacques Roof had instructed Charles de Gaulle to get as many dollars converted to gold as he could because it wasn't going to last.
The idea of being paid IOUs with greenbacks instead of gold coins or gold bars was a very scary prospect for Roof. And it wasn't only de Gaulle, but it was also the Swiss who started saying, something is afoot here. There is a major change, and we could be on the side of this where we get shortchanged.
Well,
so they were very active, very proactive in taking gold and having it distributed to them in Europe.
Strangely enough, you know, that was a period of time when Johnson had said, we're going to be printing money to pay for these things. And Ben Bernanke is saying the same thing right now with QE to infinity.
Well, what Ian is suggesting is a unique perspective, because what he's really implying is that the international community is in the midst of recognizing something that is going to change, something in the monetary structure which is going to change, because that is in fact what was happening during that 68 to 71 period. And it wasn't something that you necessarily discussed at cocktail parties. It was something that you discussed behind closed doors, because there was a strategy that had to be put in place and orchestrated without tipping your hand as to what it was exactly you were doing or why you were doing it.
Well, is this similar to what we see the Chinese doing right now? I mean, they have an official amount of gold that they say they own, yet you were just in Hong Kong, David. You saw the flows of gold that are not being reported. There's a whole lot that's not going onto the balance sheet right now.
And beyond China, it's the developing worlds which have massive amounts of, again, they've benefited from trade surplus dollars all these years.
So they have trillions.
Exactly. And it's this shift, and I think it's important to remember that a shift in sentiment is something that is almost imperceptible. Mm-hmm. You can go from being a skeptic one day to being a believer the next. And the skeptic would say, we don't understand necessarily the source of our bias, but we don't think that we want any gold, and we don't think that it's necessary. And you can, over a 6, 12, 24-month period, find yourself in a camp that sees it as absolutely necessary, not necessarily understanding how you went from being skeptic to believer. But I think that change is afoot. We are watching the international community, again, participate imperceptibly with a shift in sentiment. What was negative sentiment towards the barbaric relic, quote-unquote, is shifting to positive sentiment, but it's not in the developed world. It's in the developing world, and it's central bankers there who actually have the money to divert from other fiat currencies, be that the euro, the Japanese yen, the U.S. dollar, to a hard asset in part.
Well, and David, for the person who wants to read that book, The Monetary Sin of the West by Jacques Roof, it's about that period of time in the 60s where the international community started to get a hint that the gold standard wasn't going to last much longer, and they started loading up quietly on gold. And that book is fascinating. We have it in our resource section at McIlvaney.com. So for a person who would like to read it for free, it's a lot cheaper than the used, the very nice used version you bought me, which was close to $200. But well worth reading. And if this is a situation that's repeating at this point where you have people quietly accumulating gold, you know, in the past, Jacques Roof was vindicated in the end.
Well, there's two more things that we should comment on just from this ongoing conversation with Ian. One is that central bank motive for having a part of their resources in precious metals is actually very similar to your sophisticated investor in the sense that they're looking for a monetary asset, something that provides both liquidity and safety, not right. just one, but both, and does it without having counterparty risk. And as Ian has said, that's where gold is a standout in terms of a reserve asset, and as a reserve asset and as a monetary asset in the modern era. This point is critical, and I think it's one that can easily be lost on the man on the street because, you know, what is even counterparty risk, counterparty exposure? That doesn't even compute. I've done banking business with the local bank down the street for 50 years. Why would I?
Never lost money.
Never lost money, never right. considered who my quote-unquote counterparty risk was, the idea that that bank could go under or that one of their lending partners could go under, and that would have a ripple effect into your world. And yet we do have real-world, real-time experiences over the last 36 months of institutions which were bulletproof, now left as bullet-riddled and dead.
Well, you know what's amazing about a person who does finally experience that counterparty risk in a bad way? It's a profound change in their life. They never trust anything that's paper again. I think about the people who lost money on MF Global here recently. They were stunned. It's for most of them, it has never happened before. But from this point forward, it'll never happen to most of those people again.
Now, the second part, I think, is interesting. And so one aspect is who is buying gold. It's the sophisticated investor concerned with counterparty risk and a central banker who is also looking at their credit risk in a very different light. And certainly that'll accelerate over the next several years. But it's also, and this is point number two, it is this Dow-gold ratio that is compelling from a growth standpoint. We often look at gold from the vantage point of insurance, and I think that's the healthiest position to take.
Sure.
But as an insurance policy, something that is ensuring your purchasing power on an ongoing basis, you can look at your purchasing power in terms of currency terms, which really limits your ability to see what it has done for you, because all you're doing is looking at it in terms of nominal appreciation or depreciation.
But that currency is going down in value, whereas if you measure it in something else...
The stuff of a company, the stuff of acres, the stuff of single-family homes, and look at your increased purchasing power in those terms, it's compelling. Again, it's difficult for me, I think, to see the 68 to 71 period as an exact replication here in this period, except that I am reminded by Ian that the international community is behaving very similarly. As skeptics moving to the position of believers, maybe we do need gold. But having said that, from an investor standpoint, we've gone from a 43-to-1 ratio,
right,
Dow to gold, a cross-section of the Dow buying 43 ounces of gold to now it buying 8 ounces of gold.
Yeah.
That five-fold increase in purchasing power, as compelling as it may seem, pales in comparison to the 7- to 8-fold increase in purchasing power.
Where you go from 8-to-1 down to 1-to-1.
Immediately in front of us.
Yeah.
And I think this is where, for someone looking at 1775 and the gold price, anything short of 2000 and saying it seems rich, well, rich relative to what? Rich relative to its nominal value in dollar terms, yes, but in terms of its ability as an asset to preserve your purchasing power. The journey from 8-to-1. To 1-to-1 is far more powerful. The benefits derived are far greater than anything you've seen in the last 10 years. That is worth pondering.
Well, you know, David, it's interesting. Somebody that I know who's been in the precious metals business now 26, 27 years, he says it's just simply like this. There's two types of people. There are those who buy because they fear the system's broke, and then there's other people who are buying to try to make money. And what you're saying is there are two audiences right now, and there's nothing wrong with being a little bit of both.
Well, exactly. You've got the central bank community, which is beginning to change their sentiment towards gold. You've got the investor community, which has looked at gold and said, why would we own it when we can own things that are far more sophisticated and fancy? We don't need the barbaric relic. And they're in the process of changing their tune on the basis of a 10-year track record. But then you also have the concerned party who says there are issues which the system is not addressing, and we fear that there is a comeuppance some way, somehow, somewhere, and we don't want all of our assets exposed to the vagaries of the market.
So, David, this is why you've preached over and over, rehearsing an exit strategy, because at some point that insurance position grows to excess as you get towards the top of the market. Let's say that we are nearing that 1-to-1 ratio on the Dow. person who owns gold, they're going to love it at that point because it's done so much for them, but they, at that point, also have to start making decisions elsewhere.
And as Ian has said, you don't wait for the perfect number. You don't rehearse for perfection. We're talking about a very messy world. We're talking about a world that is full of concerns and even stresses and strains in an environment where gold and the Dow are trading at a 2-to-1 or even a 1-to-1 ratio. This is not a world where you're making very clear-cut decisions. It's a world that is very, very concerning, very, very disturbing. And you need to. You need to have already rehearsed those decisions, as you say. But this is classic. We've seen this 3-4 instances in this century,
right,
where the advantage of owning physical assets and making the transfer to paper assets has been profound. We've talked before about the Bass brothers making that transition where the Hunt brothers did not. And they recognized a change in the market which was going to put an end to the rise in precious metals. That was Fed policy in the past. That was different leadership in Washington in the past. We don't have that today. We don't have anything in the next 3 to 4 years which is any semblance of a Volcker-Reagan combination to restart the system.
But maybe there's light at the end of the tunnel.
And there is, but I think we're talking about 2015 to 2016 and a long journey from here to there. Do you have the plan in place? Have you rehearsed your strategy? Here in the present tense and into the future, this is something that needs to be done today, not tomorrow.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Ian McCavity. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.